Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Thank you. Proceed.
May it please the court. When the Hill family came to see me in January of 2010 at my house at my dining room, and they're here today, and told me that their father had fallen down at the hospital in Fenton at St. Clair SSM, hit his head, and that he died 7 weeks later after being in coma, and that there was a video, and that the video had disappeared, gone missing. The video showed how he fell. I told them that's not to worry about that. That's not true. That can't be. That at 2009, there's a video. It's a computer. Computers are designed to preserve evidence. We'll find the video, and that'll be the end of it. So I got a hold of the claims people at SSM that I've known for a very long time, Ms. Martis, et cetera, and said, let's see the video. She said it overrode itself. It taped over itself in 10 days. Then I'll just shorten this because this is 9 years of litigation, 22 depositions, $85,000 trying to figure out what happened to that video that showed how that man fell. And so the evidence ended up showing that they violated all of their policies in terms of preserving evidence, investigating, keeping the evidence. It's a computer. They originally said it didn't have the capacity to preserve the evidence. We couldn't hit the preserve button on a computer, which are specifically designed for that purpose. We hired a forensic computer man from Mr. Puglio. Mr. Puglio proved beyond any question that not only was that false from a physical event, meaning it could not have overridden itself within 4 days. Mrs. Hill had gone to the office the morning after the fall to look at the video. It was gone. It could not be seen. That testimony was uncontradicted. The evidence showed that they went ahead 7 weeks after the fall, laying aside all this 10 days, 7 days, 3 days, all of these morphing things, the nurses, the operating room suites that used up all this video, that was all hearsay. All of that was hearsay. So that at the trial, we showed that all of their excuses were false. And so at the end of the day, October 22nd of 09, 7 weeks after this fall and this man's death, shortly after he died, within a week, they went and had the computer hard drive removed, wiped out, completely eliminated any possibility, according to our expert, undisputed by theirs, Mr. Manis, 877 to 899, 12 pages of deposition, 12 pages of trial testimony, which was nonsense, total nonsense. So the facts of the spoliation were clear. The trial court, we asked to impose the spoliation rule as discussed by the cases. And, you know, as I've gotten into this case, it's really an amazing thing. It goes back to the 1820s, the first time this court started talking about spoliation. And the first time there was a big discussion was in Pomeroy, 1874. These are all cited in the brief. And the first time this court spoke said, the law furnishes a stringent rule to deal with the spoliator. 1882, Pomeroy second time around. The law hates spoliators and thwarts his purposes by supplying the lost proof. 1921, Hunt, admission of the facts that what the missing evidence would have shown, going down to Garrett, which is what the Court of Appeals said. Garrett says in the bad order card case, the flat wheel case, the Court of Appeals said, yes, it's an admission. They are held to admit in law, 1953, that the evidence that they destroyed, the missing evidence, would have shown what the adverse party said it would have shown.
Now that's different than an adverse inference.
I know it is.
An admission is essentially a partial directed verdict.
No, it isn't.
On that issue.
No, it isn't. Or
if it's a contested issue.
Yeah, I agree. It is a contested issue. I'm not saying it's a binding admission. Garrett didn't say it was a binding admission. None of the cases have said it's a binding admission.
What else would it, what else would it be?
Evidentiary admission.
I'm sorry?
What else would it be? An evidentiary admission?
Yes. Yes. That's what it is. All the cases talk about spoliation being a evidentiary sanction. Okay? We're not talking about a directed verdict here.
So they could explain it. Because I was going to ask, opposing counsel says you're in effect asking for a directed verdict on that, but you're simply saying the jury should be told they admitted this by not producing it and they can come back and explain it, you're saying?
Yes. They get to put on evidence. It's not a binding admission, but it's an admission.
But you're asking, you were saying, this is the Court of Appeals found in your client's favor, but it did not go as far as you would like it to do. You would like this court to say the jury should have been told they admitted he fell over the crack.
I'm not sure if you're asking if about an instruction at this point, or if you're just asking if in argument the part.
Is there an inconsistency, and I think you both have dealt with this in your brief, in our rules, in our cases say you can't have an instruction, but you're saying but you have to tell the jury it's an admission. How else do you tell the jury?
Well, the courts have said consistently no instruction, so the lawyers get to argue it. Right. So that would be the way it would be done, in my opinion. In the absence of an instruction, the lawyer gets to say to the jury, the law in this case is, just like you can argue the law that aren't all included in the instructions, the law in this case is that the defendant is held to admit that the evidence that they destroyed would have been helpful, would have shown. I'm saying that Garrett says would have shown exactly what the other party is saying it showed. That would be fair. And remember, spoliation of evidence, destruction of evidence is a crime. It's a crime.
Is there any case that says you actually get to argue it that way as opposed to arguing the inference?
Oh, yes. Let me say yes. Yes. In the cases that we cited from around the country, all the other cases in our brief from all the states, you know, there are states that impose default judgments, strike all affirmative defenses. The Eighth Circuit gives an adverse inference instruction. So unusual. Yeah. This is not extreme that we're suggesting here.
Well, but it seems you've gone past at least one possible distinction. You know, where there is misconduct in the course of discovery, a court could impose as a sanction all of the things you just said, an admission, strike their pleadings, enter judgment against them. All of those are available as sanctions.
Yes.
But you're not talking about sanctions.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
What I'm saying is this is before discovery starts. This is pre-litigation. Misconduct. This is spoliation of evidence.
I want you to answer his question, but
I think I'm trying to.
I know, but I'm interrupting you, and I apologize for that.
I apologize.
But if there was evidence, and there may have been in this case, that they destroyed it prior to litigation with the thought that it may come up in litigation, couldn't the court sanction that action?
Of course. No problem.
Didn't purport to do that. That's what I'm trying to get. The court was unwilling to sanction their conduct either during discovery or prior to discovery.
Judge, if I may, it was a motion to apply the spoliation doctrine that was denied, which is what we're appealing, okay? We asked the court to hold, as Garrett did, and back to 1874, it's an admission that the evidence they destroyed would have supported our case. That's what we asked the court to do. The court, it was before Judge McLaughlin, he denied the motion.
So what should the court have done then? How do you make an evidentiary admission as a court?
Okay, so in the way I see it, the way the Supreme Court has said, they're held to admit it. So
that's illegal. See, I see that as a legal admission, not as an evidentiary admission.
Well, the cases say that let me say this. Garrett literally says that they are held in law to admit. Garrett specifically says they are held in law to admit that the evidence would have been damaging, that would have proved there was, those words were not on the bad order card that was a copy that the injured railroad worker made up.
So if it's an evidentiary admission, not a legal admission, how does the court do that? How does the court do an evidentiary admission to the...
How does the jury know about it?
I think
it can't be a secret between the parties and the judge. How does the jury know about it?
I think it could be an instruction to the jury saying, if you believe that the defendant or the plaintiff spoliated this evidence with in bad faith with the intent to conceal the truth, then you must infer.
So that's telling.
Then you must believe that that is an admission as against this defendant, not a binding. Judge, I understand what you're saying.
But we're not
talking about a directed verdict.
Can you get to that? And the cases may not be clear on this. What's for the court to decide and what's for the jury to decide? Here the court refused to find it was intentional and it was in bad faith.
Yes.
Is that appropriate for the court to decide? The court, though, let you argue that in adverse inference to the jury, not the admission, but that you could infer that it was that it was detrimental to their case. So, but the court denied the spoliation motion. It was a little confusing.
It is a little confusing, but the end of the sum and substance is, in my opinion, the best way to do this, because it's important. It is important. Destroying evidence, all the years of litigation, if we had 1,000 words, how about a 1,000 days, hundreds of thousands of dollars, 50 witnesses. It was unbelievable. But we got down to it, and everything they said was false about what happened to that evidence. So the point being, how to get it to a jury? In my opinion, it's a pretrial hearing on a motion, just like a motion for sanctions. This is a motion for application of the spoliation doctrine. And say, Judge, here's what we've proven. And here we are. And we want you to permit us to tell the jury an opening statement. If you don't want to do an instruction with that, you know, refer it to the Supreme Court committee, et cetera, fine. Pretrial, the court says, I believe you've proved it. And therefore, I'm going to permit you to argue or tell the jury that this is an admission that evidence would have shown in our case Mr. Hill tripped over the raised slab. Now, let me say, that doesn't make it a directed verdict because you still have to prove duty, breach, and damages. So it's whatever
goes to. And you have to prove that. If it's an evidentiary admission, it's like a prior pleading, if you did
abandoned
a petition
pleading.
And you abandoned pleading,
sure.
That's an evidentiary admission,
but it's not binding.
Correct.
Right. So that's what I'm saying.
But do we even have to reach any of this if we accept your argument that their closing argument was prejudicial and requires a new trial because they purported to say there's no instruction, therefore the
that's
court
point
didn't
two,
find.
And I think it's well taken. I think I'm entitled to a new trial
really
on all five.
Can you address that very quickly for us? Because your time is up, actually.
Oh, it
but
is.
I'd like to hear your, if you could just address that quickly.
I will,
why do you think
certainly.
That's
so, as you know, as everyone here knows, misstatements of the law in closing argument are strictly prohibited. Mr. SSM counsel gets up in closing and says, no instruction on adverse inference. Mr. Dowd talks about adverse inference. No instruction on that. So what can I say about adverse inference? There's no instruction on that, number one. But number two, and this is even more important on the misconduct in closing argument. Counsel was told that he was not permitted to mention, and I've got the orders here, he was not permitted to mention what Mr. Reeder, the security guard that says he saw what happened, was not to mention what he saw on that video in a written order. It's in the appendix. And so he said, in closing argument, he specifically violated that order by the court and said, and believe me, the hospital, during the course of this case, has paid the price. Mr. Reeder did not talk about anything that he saw on the video. Videotape.
Now, you didn't object to that.
I did not. I was in shock, but I don't have to, because a misstatement, a violation of a court order, this is different than just a random closing argument. He had been ordered not to say that, and he said it. So am I supposed to get up and say, Judge, I object, and let the jury know that I don't like them hearing that he can't tell them what Reeder said? No. Did I decide to do that? No. I was in shock that he said it. He had been ordered not to say it. So I don't think I'm required, honestly, to preserve an argument that has already been prohibited, and I cited a case to the court that says you don't have to object.
Thank you, counsel.
You don't get off that easy.
I'm sorry?
You don't get off that easy. I've been very patient to wait for my question.
All right.
Because I can, in addition to this legal issue doesn't get to this level very often.
Right.
And my question to you is, why wouldn't it be better to resolve this issue by permitting a jury instruction that might say may or might say must, depending upon what the trial court found relative to spoliation, sure, or as to what the evidence was.
Yes, sir.
Why wouldn't the better policy be to at least permit within the judge's discretion a jury instruction on this issue?
Absolutely. That's what it should be. Just because all of the history where the court says no instructions, although there is some law that we cited that instructions were given on the adverse inference, there is some law to that, Missouri law. But the one we suggested, because the Court of Appeals suggested in a footnote, maybe you ought to look at sending this to the Supreme Court. And what we suggested, and I discussed it in depth with Alex Amagi, trying to figure out what would be fair, that this court might think, okay, that's fair. As a result of the defendant's failure to produce the video of Mr. Hill's fall, you are instructed to infer that the video would have shown that Mr. Hill tripped over the raised slab of concrete at the entrance to the procedure center at St. Clair's Health Center, okay? To infer. We didn't say you are instructed to find, or you must find. You see what I'm saying? So that it's not, again, a directed verdict saying, okay, that's the end of the story, although we fashioned this based on the idea that you all might want to, in fairness, you know, balance something or other. But Garrett actually says and its progeny say it's an admission of the exact facts that you're claiming it would have shown. The cases say it. So, I mean, it's clear. So that's how I think it ought to be done. Thank you.
One last question.
Yes, Your Honor.
You indicated because there was a prior court order prohibiting reference to Mr. Is it Reeder's conduct or what he would have seen, that you weren't required to make an objection. But the prior order was an interlocutory ruling, which the trial court might have changed during the trial.
And even if
the trial court wouldn't have changed it, your failure to object precluded the trial court from responding at that time, which might have prevented a retrial. So why should you not be required to make the objection to preserve it and give the trial court an opportunity to correct that error in that trial rather than compel a retrial?
Judge, I respectfully don't agree with your premise that it was an interlocutory order.
Any order the trial court enters prior to final judgment is interlocutory.
Well, when a lawyer is told to do this, defendant is not permitted to argue or state to the jury that we wish we could show the video to you or words to that effect, when the court tells them that, right? I have a reasonable right to rely on the court's order and on counsel not to violate that order. Why should I, as an advocate, put my position in jeopardy by emphasizing the very error that the defendant is injecting into the case? It is not fair to say a lawyer, and we cited a case to you, that a violation of a prior order from a court is misconduct, and it entitled the case that we cited, and there's no discussion about an objection in that case, or a bunch of cases where there were no objections, but cases were still reversed because of improper error. Okay, cumulative error and that sort of thing. But the cases that what we're talking about here, and I appreciate what you're saying, and my opinion is that the judge had just overruled my objection to the misstatement of the law on instructions and the adverse inference. The lawyer knew that I wasn't entitled to an instruction. We confessed to that in the instruction conference. There was no dispute. And then he got up and started talking about, where's the instruction on adverse inference? There's no instruction there. Well, what's this adverse inference about? So that's the problem there, number one. Number two.
And you did object to that.
I'm sorry?
And you did object to that argument, but it was overruled.
And, right? Overruled. Well, here we are. Seeing cases that lawyers don't like to emphasize bad things in front of a jury, just for making a record sometimes. To be honest with you, I just didn't think about objecting because I was taken aback. I really was. So plain error, we mentioned plain error in our brief. And I believe the court should take that up. That was an improper and reverse, not just for overruling the objection to the improper misstatement of law, which is strictly prohibited, as you know, but violating a prior court order. What are court orders for? You're not supposed to violate those. It's just improper, and a lawyer should not get the benefit of being able to just say it. It's the unringing the bell thing.
Counsel, you're way over time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Your Honor, I have a few of the exhibits at trial that I might share with the court. These were all admitted at trial, and I just gave a copy to Mr. Dowd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
You.
May it please the court, good morning.
You proceed.
I'm Jeff McPherson. I represent SSM, the respondent. Today, listening to the arguments, I also feel as though I'm here to stand up for Judge Preble and Judge Watkins McLaughlin, whose exercises of discretion are said to be reversible error in this case. They are not. As I said in our brief, and as shown by the record, this is not a spoliation case. This is not a case in which any evidence was ever destroyed willfully, intentionally, withheld improperly.
Counsel was permitted to argue that in closing. The jury could well have found that. So you're saying it was error to allow it to be argued that wasn't a jury question even as to what the intent of your client was?
No, Your Honor. I'm arguing that it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Preble to hold explicitly that he did not find that the plaintiff had supported his requested showing that there was spoliation in this case. That was followed by I apologize.
So are you drawing a distinction just because we've thrown these terms around, you know, everybody has, between spoliation and an adverse inference? Because the counsel was permitted explicitly to argue the adverse inference, but the court also did find no intentional spoliation. So how do those two rulings make sense? Did the court just leave it for the jury but find not as a matter of, they couldn't hold that as a matter of law, or?
Well, Your Honor, here's what happened. And I appreciate you asking me that, and because what we're talking about is the evidence that came into trial and the argument that was advanced by the plaintiff. And the record, all of this is undisputed, all of this is in the record. On October 10 of 2013, so a couple years after the case is filed, SSM moves for summary judgment because our evidence shows that the plaintiff cannot fill the gaps in his case, that he can't make the showing that's required to show that there was a defective condition at this property. And some of the documents I just gave you a minute ago are helpful to that. When I started working on this case, I didn't understand what was going on with the slab and the entrance and the brick wall and all of that. So I offer this to the court because it helped me understand what was going on. The first is Plaintiff's Exhibit 148. This is a plaintiff's exhibit showing you the entrance way to this area. The slab that we're talking about is the second one, sort of the one closer to the door, next to this little brick pillar. The next exhibit is Defendant's Exhibit C. There's some discussion in this case about Dr. Brennan. Dr. Brennan is the man who saw Mr. Hill waiting 5 or 6 minutes by this pillar before he turned to go toward the door of the procedure area. As you can see now, Dr. Brennan is standing by this pillar where he said that he saw Mr. Hill standing. And if you look down a couple of feet to the right of Dr. Brennan in this photograph, that's the seam that Mr. Hill is said to have, is alleged to have tripped over.
Is that picture taken after it's been reported or before?
This was after the 2011 modifications, Your Honor, but it was admitted after a foundation was laid as to what it showed.
But you replaced the slabs by that point, right?
They had been, Your Honor. And the
You're not telling us we should infer something about what the slabs looked like at the time from this picture?
Your Honor, I'm trying to tell you that you should infer from this where Mr. Hill was standing.
Okay.
Nothing about the conditions of the property.
Okay.
And that's all it was offered for. That's all it was admitted for. And the property is shown, the Exhibit 148, the first one I showed you, that was taken 2 or 3 days after the event.
And that, right.
Oh, exactly. And so all I'm showing you is that Mr. Hill was standing, the evidence shows, where Dr. Brennan is depicted in this photograph, a couple of feet to the right of that seam that you can see by the brick pillar. And then Exhibit M, this is a document that was read into evidence without objection. This is the note that was taken in the emergency room after Mr. Hill went in. And as you can see, it's closer printing than my eyes can take anymore. But the first entry says chief complaint, and the entry is from the doctor who examined him. Patient states he was not paying attention and does not know why he fell. Patient states he reached for the door but fell. And then a little farther down, after some more even smaller writing, it says HPI comments. Patient says he came to hospital here today to have labs drawn as outpatient, and when he reached to open a door, he fell, striking his head. What the evidence shows is that Mr. Hill was past this allegedly defective condition, got all the way to the door, and then fell. And that is shown by in Exhibit 148. This is the plaintiff's exhibit. There's a blue X right by the door. The testimony from Mr. Hill at trial was that were Mr. Hill, the plaintiff. The testimony from him at trial was that was where the fall was, well past this purported condition. And so getting back to the spoliation question, there's no doubt that the video was not available and it was not could not be admitted into evidence. And so what the plaintiff moved for on October 18 of 2013 was the application of the spoliation doctrine. On January 21 of 2015, after a lot of discovery, Judge Preble indicates to the parties that he's going to deny SSN's motion for summary judgment. He's also going to deny the motion for the spoliation doctrine. 2 days later.
Go ahead.
I'm almost there, Judge. 2 days later, and this is on in the legal file at page 1408, the plaintiff moves in limine to exclude Mr. Reeder's testimony about what he saw on the video and to redact Mr. Reeder's report about what he saw on the video on the basis of the spoliation argument that is incorporated by reference from the motion that the court says he's going to deny, and on the basis of the best evidence rule. Judge Preble enters an order, says, no, I find, and that is in the legal file at page 1650. Judge Preble finds, no, I don't find spoliation because there are no intentional acts to destroy this video, and I hope to come back to that in a minute. But Mr. Reeder's description of what the video showed is not the best evidence of that event. Therefore, on this basis and in the interest of fairness to both parties, neither that portion of his report nor his testimony about what he saw will be admitted. And so that's a granting of the plaintiff's motion for application of the best evidence rule, which essentially is what Garrett is, by the way. And so the case goes to trial. The plaintiff still can complain that the video is not available. There's nothing that's outside the court's discretion in determining which evidence to admit and which argument to allow that would prevent the court from allowing a party to talk about why the evidence isn't there. Now, this is not a spoliation case because the circuit court, both Judge Preble and Judge Watkins McLaughlin, found that there was no spoliation, and that was amply supported by the record. You heard Mr. Dowd talking a minute ago, and he's a good lawyer, he's working hard for his client, and he's advancing his arguments. He is leaving out a lot of the evidence. He's leaving out the evidence that supports the ruling of the circuit court. The record, I don't believe I'm wrong about this, Stewart v. Partamian and many other cases say that the judgment of the circuit court on matters of discretion like this is to be viewed in the light most favorable to the court.
Why wasn't it a question for the jury whether the intent with which the videotape was destroyed, where it couldn't be found, where it was searched for the next day, where then you wrote over all and rebooted the system so all the history of who'd gone into it was destroyed. You offered explanations for all those that are innocent. They offered explanations that were not innocent. Why wasn't that a question for the jury?
Well, all that evidence was presented to the jury, and the argument was presented to the jury.
So it is. So it's the jury. And so, again, I'm coming to my question. You're drawing a distinction between they're allowed to argue an adverse inference, but not spoliation. What you're saying is a finding of intentional destruction. That I'm just trying to find exactly how you're distinguishing those two concepts.
Well, Your Honor, we're here because the jury came back with a defense verdict.
I understand. Can you draw the distinction between spoliation and adverse inference for me? Explain how you interpret both.
Okay.
Because you're saying there was no spoliation, but they could argue the inference. So it may be my lack of understanding, but if you could explain how you understand.
What I was going to do is answer the first part of your question first,
okay,
which was, what's the difference? The difference is a defense verdict was entered here. The court permitted discussion, argument, extensive argument, and extensive evidence in an attempt to support an adverse inference, mm-hmm, in the absence of a finding of spoliation. If the jury had come back with a verdict for the plaintiff after that, I would be standing here because that was improper.
Why?
There was no finding of spoliation.
Why is that improper? That's what I'm struggling with. If in a criminal case, if a bank robber throws his gun over the river, and he's got a great explanation for that, he wanted to keep the gun away from his kids, the jury gets to hear all that evidence, and then the jury decides whether or not he was trying to destroy the evidence because he robbed a bank, right? So why, and there wouldn't be no motions, there wouldn't be anything to dealing with this. How did this area of the law get to where it's at right now?
Well, two things on that. Bank robbers do say funny things, but you're right. The evidence, the plaintiff is entitled to put on his evidence that he thinks supports his case. And is it relevant that there was a video? Is it relevant that it's not available now? Can you explore the veracity of witnesses by asking them how it was that the video came not to be available? I believe all that is admissible, Your Honor. The arguing the inference, I think, is an emanation of the spoliation rule, and I don't think that is proper. I think you can question the truth and veracity of the witnesses on the basis of what happened prior to the
doesn't
trial.
Doesn't that suggest they're using it as a legal term, inference, but really what they're doing is they're arguing an evidentiary inference to the jury that, hey, they're good for this. They're liable for this because they tried to hide the evidence that it happened.
And that happens every day in every case in lots of ways. There's nothing wrong with all of that, Your Honor. But in terms of the spoliation cases that are sought to be advanced here, in the absence of a finding of spoliation, I don't believe the cases say that it's proper to argue all of that. However,
the Court of Appeals said that it should be reversed because the court should have determined there was spoliation here. So they're saying that the trial court was in error to find there was no spoliation.
The Court of Appeals sure did say that, Judge Draper, and the Court of Appeals was respectfully incorrect.
Right. Okay.
The evidence shows, and this could not be clearer, the first witness who was called was Mr. FitzHenry. The second witness was Mr. Reeder. Those are the two security guards. And the evidence they gave was that Mr. Reeder saw the video right after it happened. He's going to write up his report, and so it's 6 days later. He and they both believe the computer guy, Mr. Berger, the computer guy, Mr. Wozlik, everybody thought that this hospital, which had opened on March 30 of 2009, just 5 months and a couple of days before this event, they all thought the video stored for 7 days. So they sat down at the monitor, Mr. Reeder, Mr. FitzHenry, this is undisputed, sat down at the monitor expecting to have the video there so that they could
look at it. Well, there was also evidence that the injured person's son went there the day after it and asked for it, and they said they couldn't find it and that you couldn't record it. There was a lot of evidence on both sides as to what happened. You can't be saying there's no jury question on that issue.
Oh.
And the court should have refused to submit that question to the jury of the motivation?
Well, Your Honor, if you heard me say that, then I misspoke and I withdraw that, although I feel like I didn't.
Well, you said both. You said, of course, it's for the jury, and the court should not have allowed him to argue it. So you can't really do both.
Well, in response to Judge Draper's question about whether the circuit court should have was required to find spoliation into this record, the record in the light most favorable to the judgment, indeed, if you just look at it, these men did not think that video was gone. They expected it to be there. They went there to write out. He invited his supervisor to sit with him and look at it so they could write up a report. That's not an effort to hide or lose anything, Your Honor, and they didn't think it was gone yet. So they called the computer guy. Mr. Wasilek sends Mr. Berger. Mr. Berger's said to be some kind of flunky. He's not. He's got a degree in computer science.
I'm interrupting you because you're down to the end of your time. Why was it not error to argue there was no instruction?
Your Honor?
An adverse inference from the failure to instruct.
Well, Your Honor, here's what happened. In the closing argument on behalf of the plaintiff, the plaintiff's closing argument says, here's the adverse inference. The law says you can find against them on the loss of this video. There's no objection. You can argue your case. But toward the end of that, the plaintiff's argument says, so in any event now, on the adverse inference, as you recall, there was in the instruction you are given, I think it's instruction number 11, which is a reference to the instructions that the court is just going to read or has just read to the jury. There's a reference that there's an adverse inference instruction. And so the defendant's response is.
No, wait a minute. You didn't object. They said that they misspoke and corrected it. You didn't object to that. That's not a license for you to. I mean, you misstated the law, that there's no instruction, therefore you can't draw an adverse inference. That's very serious.
That would be serious if it happened, Your Honor. It definitely did not happen.
Well, I'm reading the language. It says, in the instructions which the law, you will not find one word in here to say anything about spoliation, loss of evidence, and you should then render a verdict in favor of the Hills. Nothing about that, but of course, by law, there can't be.
Your Honor, respectfully, that's in response to what the plaintiff said on the 8th. On the adverse inference, as you recall, there was in the instructions that you have been given, I think it's number 11, he's saying that there's an adverse inference instruction that the court is giving to them.
But he was referring to instruction 11, which is not an adverse. So
it isn't.
Right.
It absolutely is not.
And he referred.
And he said that it was. And so, in response, all that is said.
And was there an objection to that by defense counsel? If you thought he was misstating and was trying to suggest that was an adverse inference instruction?
Well, Your Honor, he says that there is an instruction that the court has given you. And that's incorrect. Okay. It certainly is incorrect. There is no adverse inference instruction. None was asked for. All that the argument for the defense says is in the instructions, which are the law that is given to you, there is nothing about spoliation. That's not a legal instruction. That's not a declaration to the law, declaration to the jury about what they should find or what they should not find. That's telling them what is in the instructions. And it's unassailably true. That is a factual statement. These instructions did not include anything about spoliation. And as a result, you should find an adverse inference. That is a fact. That's not a law. That's not a misstatement of the law.
Well, but one doesn't infer from the other. By law, there can't be an instruction on it. So that's not a reason.
No one said that there could be. No one said that there could be an instruction and there isn't one. All this is just a correction of a misstatement. There's it's 100% accurate. Mm-hmm. Now, going back to instructions, I see I'm woefully short of time here. Apropos of instructions, Mr. Dowd mentioned an instruction that's in his appendix. This was never submitted to the circuit court. I actually drafted a motion to strike this from the appendix because it's not properly part of the record. However, I take it as being an example of what the plaintiff might ask for. And I'm happy to have it because this is a directed verdict instruction. This directs the jury to infer that the video would have shown that he tripped over the raised slab. This is the same that's in the verdict director. This directs a verdict on elements of the claim. I don't see how that's anything other than an attempt to get a directed verdict. And the reason I think that, we're here on point one because the motion for application of the spoliation doctrine was denied. That motion asked the court to find, this is in the prayer, that the court is requested to make an order and finding that the defendant has admitted as a matter of law that the video and notes, if not destroyed, would have shown that Mr. Hill tripped over the unlevel walkway at the entrance to the procedure center, which caused Mr. Hill to fall, and that the jury be instructed accordingly at trial. Respectfully, the court could not properly have granted this motion. That's a motion for a directed verdict. It's an unsupported motion for a summary judgment. It's a request for an instruction that cannot properly be given under Missouri law. The MAI is a system. It does not comment on evidence. It doesn't make abstract statements
of
law.
Now, there's not an MAI as well now.
There are.
There are instructions that are not in MAI that are accepted.
That is absolutely true, Your Honor, and not an MAI instruction can be proper if it doesn't run afoul of the requirement that you can't make abstract statements of law or comment on the evidence. And so I agree 100% that there can be not an MAI instructions, just not about the kind of inferences that are sought to be found in this case. Now, are there court systems that allow that kind of thing? Sure. The plaintiff has pointed the court to the Stevenson case, the Morris case from the Eighth Circuit. Those courts do not follow the MAI. And in those courts, the only time you're allowed to have a spoliation instruction is when the federal district court finds that there is intentional spoliation. This court did not find intentional spoliation, and it was certainly not an abuse of discretion for the court not to find it, because there was ample evidence that there never had been any intentional effort to keep this video from being shown to anyone. The circuit court, both two experienced circuit judges found that, because there is ample evidence that this is a brand new hospital, that the way the video system was set up, that there was not enough capacity to have all of these videos stored for the 7 days that they requested to be there, that they requested to be saved, that they expected to be saved. It turned out it was more like three. And so by the time these men, Mr. Reeder, Mr. Fitzhenry, working guys who don't have a reason in the world to try to delete a video or hide a video, these men sat down in front of the monitor together expecting to see that video, and it wasn't there. They were surprised. It was not intentional. I see I'm well over my time. I appreciate the court's indulgence. SSM appreciates the court's time and attention. For the reasons set forth in our brief, we would ask that the judgment of the circuit court be affirmed.
The evidence that counsel just referred to about Mr. Hill being past the trip point that we're talking about was that which was created by them on the morning of Dr. Brennan's deposition, when they did not tell me that the picture that they were relying on in that deposition was taken after the slab had been repaired. That was not told to me at the deposition. So that is false to say that they proved that Mr. Hill was past the trip point beyond any question, because that was the scene with Dr. Brennan where they went out that morning and walked him through it. He said 65 times in his deposition, right, to Mr. Ott when he deposed him without telling me about the false pictures. Then the false pictures, if you recall, point four in our brief, misrepresented to the court when those pictures were taken. And so we asked for a sanction there. No Dr. Brennan deposition. They concealed the fact that they took him out there, and they concealed the fact that they had taken pictures and used them in the deposition, which would have shown that there was a defect in the walkway for the purpose of demonstrating that there was no defect and that Mr. Hill didn't fall at the trip point. So that is false, number one. Number two, the Debbie Owens, they said there's no evidence there was a defect. Debbie Owens, or Sherry Hausman, was the president of SSM St. Clair. She testified that it was a dangerous condition. She wrote an email that said it was the very condition we're talking about here. That's over. That's the truth. They say also in connection where he was, Debbie Owens, the lady that was sitting behind the desk at the entrance center there, she said he fell 5 feet from the entrance to the doorway. That's where his body was, which puts him right in between the trip point and the door, not where Dr. Brennan put him after 3 years and after going out there with the lawyers for the defendant. So, if I may, they said that it was okay to argue that there was, because there was no instruction, that there was no adverse inference. That's false. You cannot knowingly misstate the law in closing argument. Everyone here knows that. The law is the most precious thing that we have. I'm so privileged to be a part of our justice system. I can't believe that I've had this privilege all these years. But the law is the guiding light. And the law is what you are, the voice of the people of the state of Missouri on the law and how it's going to be administered. And in this case, destruction of evidence, misrepresenting to the court, misstating law to the jury knowingly, violating court orders, having an expert witness, Dr. Huss, hired gun, not a treating doctor, hired gun from out of town. He comes in, says in deposition, I take his deposition, did Mr. Hill's underlying medical condition, do you think, contribute to cause him to fall that day? I don't know. Could have been. You know, he did have some dehydration in his records afterwards. I said, so you're not saying it contributed to cause reasonably, are you? And he says, no, it could be possible. At trial, he said it was likely, probable. Mm-hmm. And the judge overruled our objection on the central issue in the case, the crucial issue in the case. So,
counsel,
thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to, I'm glad you accepted transfer of this case, because this is a really important issue for everyone in this state. Thank you so much.
It was a well-argued case on both sides. Case will be submitted.